In prison most of his life. He said for the last few years he'd been really, he said he knew he wanted liberation but didn't even, he was looking for liberation but didn't even know, didn't know he wanted it and wasn't even sure what it was, you know, but he somehow when he heard about it, he realized that's what he'd been wanting, for liberation. And so liberation from suffering sounds kind of quite heavy, doesn't it? This word liberation, already it sounds quite heavy. And then suffering is a word that, you know, we all know very well. But it's not a very appealing word. So what does Buddha mean by liberation from suffering? Well, there's different ways of packaging, if you like, packaging Buddha's teachings. Basically the principle, the one here, the context for this one is one package, if you like, known as the Four Noble Truths, you know. And the first one of the things that's really important listening to Buddha's teachings is to hear them, as not as some remote religious concept, but actually what Buddha is doing is describing, in his opinion, you know, as Buddha's teachings, are describing our psychology. This is not meant to be some kind of cliche, you know, it's actually true. Buddha is dealing with the human consciousness, dealing with the mind, dealing with our reality. So the context here is this one called the Four Noble Truths. And this first one is that there is suffering. Quite blunt, you know, simply there is suffering. The second is that there is a cause of it. The third, and this interestingly, is in a sense the real one, is that there is a possibility to be free of it. And then the fourth are the methods. So the context being that there is a possibility to be free of suffering. If we even listen to this, and it's kind of, it's interesting. I mean, this is what my friend Francisco was saying. He wanted to be free of suffering. He didn't know if there were any means to it, but he knew he was fed up with suffering. Okay, his particular type of suffering is being involved with gangs and murdering and knifing and shooting and wars and dramas, you know. There's that kind of quite intense sort of suffering. And I suppose if we want to, so okay, if we can even begin to consider that there's a way of being free of it, then it's quite reasonable, isn't it, therefore, to know what it is. We have to be very clear about what we're talking about. And then if we really do believe we can be free of it, then the second one is obvious. Well, what are the causes of it? Because obviously the fourth one, which is the way to get out of it, is the way to eliminate the causes, isn't it? So it's very, in other words, a very practical thing. There are weeds in your garden. There are causes of the weeds. There is a way of being free of them. You know, there is a possibility to be free of weeds, and there is a way to do it. It's kind of practical. It's like a step-by-step thing. So then, when we hear the word suffering, each of us has our own notion of it, don't we? From our own experiences and also from our own observations of the world around us. So it sounds kind of interesting, doesn't it? Kind of almost like a novel idea, that there is a way to be free of suffering. So let's look at what Buddha is meaning by suffering, and then we can, and also talking in the same time about the causes of it. And one of the most essential things in Buddhism, a person using Buddhism in their life, is that it demands that we do this kind of analysis. It's not a religious thing, in the sense that religious, in the sense that we tend to mean by religious, that is to say, sort of some kind of blind belief in something. Not like that at all. This is not the Buddhist approach at all. This is ignorance in Buddhism, sort of acting out of fear. It's really important that it's something experiential and that it's coming from our own choice and our own understanding, you know. Then we have some energy to want to do it, which makes sense. So what is suffering? Well, there are different ways, again, in the Buddhist sort of style, there are packages, different ways of presenting suffering. And one very practical one is there's three levels of suffering, three types. And the first level is very obvious. It's the kind my friend Francisco was talking about, at a very gross level, you know, harming, violence. There's the level most of us understand, perhaps we haven't been gangsters, so we might know about that. You know, we haven't murdered people. We haven't been threatened. But we maybe, you know, we get sickness, people leave us, our hearts are broken, people are unkind to us, they steal from us. We get, you know, we get sick, we get old, we get wrinkled, we get fat. Ordinary kind of level of everyday suffering. And if we look around, we can see that no one escapes this. You can be the most beautiful person on this earth, but it's guaranteed, you know. You're going to get a headache at some point. Someone's going to stop loving you. Someone's going to, you know, criticize you. This type of suffering, we can see. We all have this. So then, if we're talking here about Buddha saying you can be free of that, that's quite shocking. That's quite a radical statement, isn't it? I mean, what do you mean be free of headaches? We've been trying for how long? And look at us in our sophisticated medical systems. we haven't begun to succeed in getting rid of illness. And we, in fact, we continue to find more illnesses, don't we? I mean, we can see this. So that sounds quite outrageous. So there's a context for this, and we can discuss that in a moment. But let's look more at the second level of suffering, which is the one that's most interesting, and the one that's sort of quite shocking in a way. Because what Buddha's saying, the second level of suffering, is that, you know, it's actually what we mean. In fact, it's much more insidious. It's in fact more insidious, therefore much harder to recognize, because in fact, it's actually what we mean by happiness. Now this sounds kind of depressing, isn't it? The Buddha's saying that what we mean by happiness, the way we get it now, is in fact a particular level of suffering. So what is this one? I mean, let's look at this one. This is the essential one. So we'll look at this one at the same time, looking at what it means and then what is the cause of it. Because this is the point. This leads to then the liberation from suffering. And actually this word, you know, this Buddhist word nirvana is just the word that refers to the state of mind, if you like, of the person who, having done the job of using these Buddhist techniques, of liberating themselves from suffering. It's a psychological thing. It's not some place in heaven, you know, after this life. Not like that. So basically, what Buddha's saying is that it's what makes what we think is suffering, happiness now, actually suffering. It's really important to understand it in the context of the causes of it. And so let's look at even the causes, and so we'll talk about them simultaneously. Basically what Buddha's saying is that certain states of mind we all possess, all living beings possess, simply called anger, jealousy, pride, you know, all the way to attachment, which is almost like the root of all of these, and then in turn, even more subtly, more insidiously, one that Buddhism would refer to sort of like a deep sense of an ignorance about the very nature of how all phenomena exist. So we won't talk so much about that one now, but the one that it gives rise to most is the one of attachment. So in the sense of this fundamental one called ignorance that clings to a self-existent, solid, independent sense of me, and therefore of everything else. So this sense of me, this powerful sense of an independent, inherent, real from its own side, me-ness, actually what it gives rise to is to I want. If a strong sense of I, excuse me, a strong sense of I, a mistaken sense of I, a mistaken, miserable sense of I, in fact, gives rise to this enormous sense of I want. Because the irony of this type of ego or ego grasping or this ignorance that clings to the independent me, which in Buddhist terms is the root of suffering, the very root of suffering, and it's the uprooting of that one that brings you to what's called nirvana, the state of being. This is very deep, insidious one. This ignorance, this ego grasping. What it, ironically, the more powerful it is, the more strong, the irony is the more miserable it makes us feel, the more separate. This is one of the functions of this ego grasping. The function of it is to cause us to feel separate, cut off, alienated, lonely, separate. There's a sense of a me here against the world, you know. We all know that feeling very strongly. Well, this is the root delusion, and what it gives rise to, interestingly, is the sense of, therefore, bereft, lonely I. So naturally, a very hungry sense of I want. And this is sort of the energy of this one called attachment. So in Buddhist terms, these states of mind are the cause of suffering. And specifically, this one of attachment, I want. So obviously, there's a strong sense of neediness, a strong sense of I want. We can see in the neurotic way, it's based on a sense of not having, isn't it? Otherwise, you wouldn't. If you're not hungry, you don't eat. You don't think, I want food, do you? If you're feeling satisfied, there's no vivid sense of where is something. I want something. I'm needing something. I'm not fulfilled. I'm not complete. And this is a way of just describing the suffering of attachment. I mean, attachment, which is the cause of the suffering. So then this happiness that we, okay, so Buddha's picture is like this. We have this neurotic sense of I, which gives rise to this main one called attachment. And it's like, you know, at the gross level, you might like chocolate cake, or I like this, or I like that, and we tend to think that means attachment. I'm so attached to my children. We use the word in our culture, I think, in a very broad way that isn't necessarily the same way that we're using it here. Because attachment, in the Buddhist way of using it, is necessarily a polluted or deluded state of mind. It doesn't mean loving someone, being kind to someone, or even liking something. They're appropriate. They're totally appropriate, valid states of mind. But attachment is coming from this neurotic sense of I, a mistaken one, and this is a very important word, mistaken sense of I. It's actually mistaken, Buddha's saying. You're not like that at all. So it gives rise to these mistaken, kind of inappropriate delusions. So this attachment, kind of the subtle energy of it, is just this sense of not well-being, sense of dissatisfaction. Something isn't right. Something's always missing. Therefore, always wanting something. I mean, we know this so well, you know. So what's interesting? Okay, what's interesting is that this neediness, what it's doing all the time, isn't it, is projecting onto people and things and sounds and smells and concepts and environments, you name it, the entire world. So basically, the entire world and the people in it and the things in it really are the objects of attachment. We're talking now in the deluded sense. We're not looking at all at the moment at the positive states of mind, love, kindness, generosity, which also relate to the outside world. So dismiss those for now. We're trying to look at the problem, right? We're trying to look at the suffering. Just like when you're looking at your car, you're trying to locate the problem. You don't just sit there praising the nice leather, and you might, it's okay, but it's not getting the job done. You're trying to find the problem with the car, why it isn't working. So you're leaving the good things aside, you're happy about them, but you've got to locate the problems. And that's what this type of analysis is about, looking at the problems inside us. Because if we can all accept, we feel this sense of suffering, even if we're not sure what it means. It's a vague sense of, yes, things aren't right, and things could be better, and things always go wrong, and I don't have control over it. Then even that broad sense, we all recognize that, suffering. So we're trying to locate that suffering, and we're trying to locate the causes of it. So we can, why? Eliminate it, be liberated from it. So, okay, attachment. One of its functions, like I said, in this kind of almost primordial sense, is just the sense of neediness. Even when everything is going fine, your body's just beautiful. You know, you've got the best husband or lover on earth. Just, you know, got enough money. Everything's going well. The weather's lovely. Everything that we imagine other causes of happiness all seem to be in place. And if we dare just to sit, there's always a sense of dissatisfaction. I mean, that sense of well-being, if it is there, doesn't last long. There's a sense of dissatisfaction. And when it's really raw, then it's unbearable pain, isn't it? And things go really wrong. So the relationship between this and attachment and suffering is this, that what Buddha's basically saying is it's as if we are junkies. Just use that as an analogy. In other words, the type of mind that's intensely needing something in order to get the relief from the craving. So the way Buddha's saying now is that the happiness we get now, based, and this is the point, based on attachment, because that's how we get happiness, is actually like the mind of a junkie. That when attachment isn't getting what it wants, then there's this huge sense of, you know, frantic grasping, freaking out, miserable, dissatisfaction, things are a disaster. So then we're frantically looking for the junk to get the fix, the cake, the person, the job, the money, the good sound, the praise. You label it, you look at it, you know. And then we're craving for this, we search it out, if we get it, then we get the fix. And then we have the relief. And that relief is what we call happiness. Now, it sounds a depressing picture, but it's interesting to look at it. But what samsara is, again, this word samsara, like the opposite of nirvana, is again, it's not some place, you know, where you have pleasure, you're supposed to give up and be all miserable, which is how we tend to think of religious practice, you know. Samsara is, one simple way of saying it, is a word, just like nirvana, that refers to the state of being of a person who hasn't got nirvana, who isn't liberated from suffering, who is a junkie, who's caught up in the suffering. So the person who's given up being a junkie is like the person who's achieved the nirvana, the freedom from needing the junk in the first place. So, you know, if you're not a junkie and you look on at someone who is, and this is the context here, we can see that you don't even think about getting a fix because you don't want one, because you're fulfilled already, just using it as an analogy. You see my point. But whereas for the junkie, this whole scenario, this desperate grasping, frantic, freaking out, and then indeed because, you have to manipulate to get the object, to get the fix, and all the stuff that goes on with that, all the manipulating, all the controlling to get the fix, then the relief, the respite from that gross suffering, that relief from the suffering, in fact, feels very blissful, doesn't it, in relation to the awful craving. And that's what we mean by happiness. So the happiness we get now, it's valid, it is valid happiness. But what Buddha's saying is it's totally polluted, just like the fix. It's polluted. because it's dependent so grotesquely on this frantic craving. It's polluted though. And the second quality about it is it doesn't last. And that's evident to any one of us. The best sex in the universe does not last, you know. You've got to go do it again to get the same feeling of happiness, don't you? The best meal in the universe goes into the toilet a couple of hours later. Every single thing that we think of as being the cause of happiness, which in fact is something external, is completely actually ethereal. It doesn't last. So we've got to get the fix again. And we do this until we die. I mean, it is a depressing picture, isn't it? But it's a way of looking. It's an interesting way of looking. So if, let's just say, if there were not, in Buddha's assertion, the third noble truth, that you can be free of it, then of course it is insane to think like this. How depressing to go on about how life is suffering. If you don't have the choice to be anything but a junkie, it is foolish. You'd learn to do the best you can, deal with it, and make the most of life, wouldn't you? But the context here, and this is why it's so important, is that you can be free of this honey. So if you can be free of it, then it gives us some energy to know the causes of it and actually what it is. Do you see my point? This is the thing. First noble truth, there is suffering. Second, what are the causes of it? Third, you can be free of it. Fourth, what are the methods? So it's a very practical kind of presentation. But the key thing is here, when we're discussing this level of suffering, which is actually something we've never thought of as suffering, have we? Because why? Is because every time we look around, we don't see anybody but junkies. We're living in a world of junkies. We're all junkies, basically. So it's much harder to have any context. It takes a lot of contemplation. You know, don't just believe this, because it sounds like a depressing picture. Really learn to observe. That's the point. And that's really one very major function of the meditative approach in Buddhism, is to, through the meditative approach, to really, by listening to the teachings, like now, for example, then to take this away and chew over it, contemplate it, referring it to your actual own experiences to see if there's some truth in it. Because Buddha's saying, if you don't find truth in this, excuse me, you must leave it. You have to make it tasty for yourself, you know. And all he's doing is giving his presentation based on his own experience. So, well, you check it out and see if it's true for you too, you know. So the causes of this suffering, and this is not the only story of suffering, there's even the subtler levels as well, we won't even worry about those for now. It's very painful. I mean, if the happiness we get now is in fact suffering, it's kind of like, my God, where do I turn, you know? What's the point? So then it's reasonable, it seems reasonable to therefore think what Buddha's saying is, sorry guys, you've got to give up happiness. No, that's the point. Actually, it's interesting. This state of nirvana, which even isn't the fullest extent to which we are able to develop in Buddhist terms, a person who has achieved that state of being is so, I mean, it's a simple way to say, is so ridiculously happy. Is what comes, in other words, from Buddhist practice is extraordinary well-being. I mean, you can use words like bliss are not used lightly in Buddhism. Because what Buddhism is saying is, being this junkie now, following attachment, getting our happiness, getting the things that we believe are the causes of it, even if it's very easy for us, and for most of us it's really easy in this culture, isn't it? If we were in Kosovo right now, if we were in one of those camps, we would definitely see the pain, the immense pain of thwarted attachment, you know. Not to mention just the ordinary human things, you know. But what Buddha's saying is the extent of which we suffer is the extent of which we crave something. So like the junkie, the best thing is not to get the best junk, not to get it all the time, but to give up being a junkie altogether. Give up the craving. This is really an essential way of saying it, you know. Now, but because, like I said, because we don't have any experience of people and even in our culture, psychologies, you know, that would posit this and methods to do this. In fact, in our culture, it's seen as a shocking idea that you can completely get rid of attachment. It sounds dreadful that you can get rid of anger. You can get rid of pride. In fact, we would criticize that. We would say a well-rounded person has a reasonable amount of anger, jealousy, a bit of this, but it's under control, you know. Well, Buddha says we're really shortchanging ourselves. That's like saying you can only it's good to be a junkie, but you just got to control it and get good quality junk and you'll be cool, you know. Buddha's saying we can be beyond this altogether, and we can't even conceive, he says, of the state of being. And again, not talking about heaven. We're talking about here, you know, state of our own human mind. That the potential we have for unbelievable joy and bliss and clarity and kindness and love and generosity and all the other qualities that we know about, that we all touch upon at some point. The full development of these is what Buddha is saying is our potential, naturally, you know. This is the goal of a Buddhist. And that what's holding us back now are this presence in our mind of these pollutions, you know. The presence in our mind of these delusions, of these attachments. Anger, jealousy, and all the rest, which come as a result of attachment. You know, anger is the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants, isn't it? You know, when carrot cake comes instead of chocolate cake. You know what I mean? You've got it all worked out, all controlled, all exactly, you know, this, you want this, you want this, then the wrong thing comes. The more you've manipulated and controlled and worked out to get the one thing, and then the opposite thing comes, of course you're going to freak out, aren't you? It's just logical. Not because there's anything wrong with carrot cake, and we think there is. And not because anything so delicious about chocolate cake, and we think there is. It's only because we've done all this manipulating, you know, and had this dependence upon having the certain thing. So in other words, we're setting ourselves up for suffering. This is the whole Buddhist idea. And the causes of it are these states of mind, my states of mind, which don't come from mother and father, don't come from God or Buddha, aren't just random, but are mine, you know, have come from previous moments of themselves. It's me, it's mine. And again, what Buddha's saying is that the giving up of the neurotic attachment is actually the cause, itself, the cause of happiness. It's not as if, like we think now, well, you know, cake won't do it, so I'll try, you know, I'll try apple pie. So we keep changing the objects. It's like changing the junk. You've got to give up wanting the junk in the first place. So that usually, because we don't know another way of having any happiness, it sounds like, you know, giving up this attachment, which we are believing so deeply now as the cause of happiness. It sounds like, doesn't it, that when you've given it up, you end up with nothing. You end up kind of boring and cold and indifferent. Because we can't even conceive of any happiness without attachment. And we can't conceive of not having attachment. So we just think there's nothing left when you've given it up. And because also we think attachment is the cause of happiness. So as Lama Zopa says, when you're told you've got to give up attachment, sorry guys, you mean I've got to give up my heart, you know, my happiness? So it, for this reason, it really needs a lot of sort of very careful, subtle contemplation to really be able to discriminate between, for example, the positive qualities, love, kindness, generosity, and the neuroses, you know, like attachment, all the others. And to be able to see that attachment in itself, the more we see it, the more we look at it, the more we contemplate it, the more we taste it and understand its nature, this poison, the more we know it can't possibly be the cause of happiness. Just in the same way that we know, you know, a poison seed can't give, you know, the way they say it, it can't ripen into a medicine plant. It ripens as a poison plant, you know. So something known as attachment, the way the word is used in Buddhism, necessarily refers to a deluded state of mind, a suffering state of mind. The trouble is now we mix it. We confuse it with something, for example, called love, certainly when it comes to people. But love, in Buddhist terms, is necessarily an altruistic state of mind, you know. And interestingly, and it sounds strange, it's an accurate state of mind. Buddhism talks in terms of, you know, wisdom. The way things exist is in terms of interdependence. Everything is necessarily interdependent at very many levels, this word, you know. This is the way things exist, actually. And that what Buddhism is saying is that these deluded states of mind are, in fact, coming from an understanding that's the very opposite to interdependence. The sense of a self-existent me is actually a sense of a separate me, independent me. And so, therefore, whatever arises from that ignorance is necessarily mistaken. So attachment, for example, in this context, is a sense of this I out here, separate, alien, like I said, lonely, cut off. So then it projects onto things out there. And there's this me, and there's this like this massive division between me and it, me and you, me and other. And so of course this sense of attachment, coming from this mistaken state of mind, projects, you know, and therefore wants that thing out there to fill up this poor lonely me. So this, a whole take on all this is, from the wisdom perspective, is that it's actually inaccurate. Not just emotionally suffering, it's inaccurate. Whereas the state of mind is saying, I love her, even a small amount of love, it means, in Buddhist terms, that I want her to be happy. That I'm rejoicing in her qualities. I'm delighting in her. And the more I love her, the more affection and genuine kindness towards her there is. And that this state of mind, as opposed to attachment, which is I want her, I need her, so then you manipulate her. Do you see? So the one of love is actually accurate in the sense that it's recognizing interdependence. Almost, it's a sense of we, isn't it? There's not much difference between me and her when there's real affection there. When there's attachment, there's this incredible sense of this person out there, you're so attached to this friend of yours, so that all the manipulating comes and all the wrong stuff and all the neurotic stuff. Well, it causes suffering in the heart and causes her suffering. But what's interesting on this wisdom side of it, it actually has this quality of being inaccurate. It's coming from a sense that she's separate, whereas love comes from a sense that she's not separate. So it's a very interesting point to see it this way, you know. So these positive qualities, which Buddha says are innately within us, are in fact the true nature of what we are. And when they're fully developed is what we eventually can achieve, nirvana, all the way to becoming fully enlightened, as they call it, a Buddha, just simply meaning fully awakened. It's our natural state, Buddha says. It's our natural state. So and this is again something in Buddhism, hearing about the nature of mind, all these things, which sort of sound like interesting philosophy, to really contemplate them through meditation, through observing, through, you know, just learning to taste our own mind. The more conviction we can have of the truth of this, therefore the more impetus to develop this marvelous potential we all possess, and to rid ourselves of the junky mind. To see that it's our own mind, our own attachment, our own jealousy, our own anger, that actually is the cause of our suffering, not the people out there. This is really Buddha's key point, you know. It's within the mind. Happiness, the source of it, is in the mind. The source of suffering is in the mind. Quite literally, not just some interesting cliche, you know. Rasnama Yeshi said, I could tell you about attachment for one whole year. He said, it won't make the slightest difference until you start yourself slowly building something up in your own meditation, your own contemplations, observing it, beginning to hear, you know, hearing these words like the cold theory and relating them to your own experiences. This is what developing insight is meaning. The key, one way of saying in Buddhism is, one of the functions of a certain kind of meditation is to develop insight into how things are, which is how we're talking here, you know? And that can only come from internal, from contemplating. Slowly, slowly, building up some sense, some taste of these words, you know? Just like you do when you play the piano. In the beginning it's just mere theory, isn't it? But slowly, slowly, by practicing and practicing, you literally internalize that music until it just comes spontaneously from you, through your fingers, on the piano, for example. This is practice, you know. And it brings, and the point is here, the whole point in Buddhism is that the whole point of all this is to be experiential. That's an interesting concept. Just believing something in Buddhist terms is useless. It's a good start. It's a good start, you know, to believe when someone tells you that fire will burn you, and you don't know that yet, but you're prepared to trust them and you believe fire burns you. That's a good start, isn't it? Because it's actually going to really prevent you from burning yourself. But the most direct one is to have the experience yourself. So you know it definitely, don't you? That's the point in Buddhism. To know it yourself directly. Because the point is to have the experience. Not just to know something in the head, you know. Buddhism is dealing with our minds, with the way we think and feel, and says that we have such potential that we can't even conceive of it, you know. Potential for joy and bliss and kindness and all these qualities, that's our potential, waiting to be tapped for our benefit and certainly for the benefit of others, you know. There's no question. The key thing here we're discussing, back to this first noble truth that there is suffering, and the second of the three types of suffering, the first being ordinary, you know, everyday common garden suffering, headaches and the rest, which we all know about, but the second one, much more insidious, to really learn to see how, you know, the happiness we get now is in fact in so you know, let's look at this more, let's analyze it more, just see, not just hear it as some heavy religious thing being dumped on us by Buddha, you know. A simple example, you know, that chocolate cake. In the mind, isn't it? If you like chocolate cake, in the mind, it's absolutely clear, isn't it? It's all thought out and it's clear and absolutely accepted that when the stomach is empty and you say, I'm hungry, and then the thought arises, chocolate cake, then it's accepted, isn't it, that the cause of the happiness is the cake. We never doubt that philosophy for one second, do we? So to be told, sorry guys, it isn't, is quite shocking. Because it appears to be. Everything points to that. So if it is true, let's just put it like this, if it is true that chocolate cake isn't the cause of that happiness you get just then, you know, then it needs some analysis, doesn't it? It needs some looking at. It needs some unraveling. It needs questioning. The whole process, the whole scenario. The acceptance that cake is this, and it is this, and it is this. The acceptance that if I put it in my mouth and I feel good. All of this story needs an enormous amount of analysis, quite literally, to break. Because what Buddha is saying is we've believed something for so long that we are absolutely caught up in the truth of that. So it's very hard when you're told by somebody that it's not the cause of your happiness at all. It's quite shocking, in fact. You don't know where to turn, you know. What do I start looking at? So we can understand this idea that, you know, if you've been doing something long enough, a certain habit in your life, it's hard to change, isn't it? You don't even know you're doing it anymore. It's completely spontaneous. It's really hard to change that habit, isn't it? Well, Buddha's saying we've had this habit for eons. We've had this habit of grasping and of attachment and all the rest for so long that it is the nature right now of who we are. It's not our ultimate nature, but it's for so long. This is what he means by samsara. All living beings are cycling, locked into this story, you know, one way or another, the story of samsara, for so long that it's, I mean, what we, in fact, it's interesting, we use the word instinct and we sort of see it as, it's kind of like the deep truth, isn't it? Just instinctive, it's just who you are. All Buddha's saying is instinct is the word that refers to the deep habit of having done it so often that it feels as if this is who you are. But he says, honey, it's not your real you at all. A Buddha is a being who is now instinctively kind, loving, wise, compassionate, because that's what they've practiced. A person who can play piano so well, you can say it's just second nature, it's instinct. And we know, though, with a person who was a pianist, we can see that when they were two, they couldn't play the piano, but now look at them. A person who's the best footballer on earth, he couldn't be once, but now look at him. So we can see, even in one life, the evolution from being non-football player to the best, most instinctive one on earth. We know it was from habit, that's all. So that's all Buddha's saying even instinct is. It's just simply habit. It's an expression of the fact that we've done it so often that we just spontaneously, this is who we are, you know. You know, for example, a lion. I mean, in Buddha's terms, it was a whole interesting other point too in Buddhism. Is it Buddha's model of the mind, if you like, Buddha's psychology. It doesn't refer just to humans. It refers to every living being. Every living being. And in Buddha's terms, there are many levels of beings, many realms of beings, animals, you know, insects, a whole level called spirits, God realms, a whole levels of sentient beings, consciousnesses, minds. And Buddhist psychology refers to all of them. So a lion, for example, just in a kind of a fairly, you know, immediate like an assessment, you would say a lion has a lot of attachment and a lot of aggression, wouldn't you? I mean, not criticizing anybody, just looking. Immense attachment. Huge neediness, you know. An enormous aggression to carry out its wishes. That cause it, you know, to stalk and then to rip the guts out of that animal for its breakfast. Now in Buddhist terms, that's just, you know, we all say, oh, that's just wild animals, that's instinct, that's just how they are, you know. They're made by God and they just come this way. We don't really understand, we say. In Buddhist terms, that being, you know, is the culmination of a growth at this particular time, the manifestation of massive attachment and aggression. Each of us, in fact, is simply the manifestation, the fruiting of certain qualities within us that are manifesting at this time in this life, you know. But we would all say in the West, well, that's just how a lion is. as if it were always a lion, and you know, this is, it's got lion nature. And that's one of the crucial things in Buddhist philosophy, that yes, there is a lion there, relatively speaking, and yes, there is a Rabina here, relatively speaking, you know, a human being, an Australian, this and that. But when it comes right down to the subtlest level of our conscious being, which in Buddhist terms is what is there at the first moment of birth, coming from a previous moment, first moment of conception, and then at the time of death, that subtlest level of our being, the lion, the human, that very subtle level of consciousness doesn't possess a lion nature, human nature, male nature, female nature. There's no innate sense of a something there. Like, for example, the Christian view that there's a soul that is coming from God that has that nature, whereas lions don't have that, you know. Buddhists have a whole different story. There's very subtle consciousness at the subtlest level of our being that doesn't have a lion nature, male nature, female nature. It's like the subtlest kind of level. And it's, in a sense, the same for all beings, except another characteristic is that it bears all the imprints or all the seeds of everything that lion did in that life, and also countless past lives, because consciousness or mind isn't physical in Buddhist terms, isn't made by God or Buddha, doesn't come from mummy or daddy, isn't just something random, and isn't physical. So lion, at this particular time, due to her previous death, at the time of her previous death, at whatever type of being she was, before she was conceived in the lion's womb, mummy's womb, she was another being. And then due to the prevalence of, say, negative, very strong negative emotions, like attachment, anger, whatever, she then, when at the very subtlest level of her consciousness, when it left the previous body, then due to karmic causes and conditions, this kind of programming of her own being by her own self, by her own past actions, she then zapped into, was attracted to the egg and sperm of lions. You know, they're lions mating, and due to past karma with those particular mother and father lions, this particular being who might have been a human in the past life, powerfully attracted due to her own karma to lion energy. So she then, the consciousness zaps into lion womb and comes out as a baby mother lion, baby female lion. And she grows into lion, acts like a lion, creating karma all the time, you know. So what I'm getting at, the point here is that we don't have, there's no fundamental nature that's innately human, innately this, innately that. We have the potential for, as one lama said, for heaven and hell, for everything right there in that subtle consciousness. There are countless imprints on that consciousness from countless past lives, past energies, if you wish. And according to what we practice is what manifests. So each of us is a manifestation of certain qualities. There's one Lama Yeshe said, hell, you know, I mean, Buddhism also asserts realms of existence labeled hell realms, which are enormous suffering, right? All these different realms of existence are just different levels of suffering and intensities of suffering and pleasure, suffering and joy. And he said, hell isn't some place where some devil is waiting, saying, ha ha, I'm waiting for Tubten Yeshe. He said, no, it's the manifestation of that very, of those beings' own minds, their own experiences ripening as intense suffering. So it's in this way, if you want to assert any creator at all in Buddhism, you assert your own individual consciousness and your own past actions, karmas, that then manifest as experiences. So we are the fruit of our own past. We're not created by God or Buddha. We're not just some, you know, random set of events. We're not just created by our parents. This is the Buddha's story. And this ignorance, this sense of an instinctive sense of a self-existent, real, solid, independent me, then, depending on whether we're lion or human or what, we then hold and manifest that sense of me into the world, acting it out, you know, aggressive, depressed, angry, this, that. We believe it implicitly. This is me, we say. We either think God did it, or the devil did it, or our mother did it, or the Catholic Church did it, or somebody else did it, right? Made me. There's a sense of literally schizophrenic, isn't there? There's me here, and it was done to me somehow. It was done to me, wasn't it? I was made this way, we say, as if we have nothing to do with it. So what's most interesting about Buddhism is that we have everything to do with it. We are the creators from our own past actions. Sowing the seeds, we are now bearing the fruits, you know. So if you want to say there's a creator, it's you yourself. Not just now, like, you know, with a magic wand you manifest something, not like that. It's an evolutionary process, karma. But it's not something coming from outside. We do it ourselves. And the important kind of, the implication of this is then, wow, if I'm the creator of my own suffering and happiness, if I am the creator of what I'm experiencing now, then I can create my future experiences. Because in Buddhist terms, your consciousness, this very subtle level, they call it the indestructible consciousness. It's beginningless and endless. So, maybe anybody has some questions? Yeah. What's the way to stop being a junkie? I mean, what's the way to stop the suffering of being a junkie? It's not a trick question. What would you think? A simple way. The bottom line is you've got to give up the craving, right? Yeah. So then, the practice... Okay, you can use thousands of methods and have many people supporting you and other, even alternative drugs to help you, but the bottom line is, every time the craving arises, you go against it. You don't feed it. Well, that's really the bottom line of giving up attachment. It's the antidote to attachment is giving up attachment. How do you, you know, if you have the suffering of being a smoker, the antidote is to give up smoking. Whatever methods you use, okay, that's what Buddhist practice is. It's all the various methods, the helping methods, the supporting methods, the purification, the doing this and the doing that. But the direct one, the bottom line is when attachment arises. And this is where, okay, the very first step is to have the skill to even recognize it. And this, of course, is unbelievably difficult because we've never even thought it was suffering until now. We know that anger is suffering. It feels it. We can feel the pain. But to start being told that just the want, you know, what we call is, well, I just want a piece of chocolate cake. What are you talking about? How can that be suffering? It sounds pretty brutal. So then the very first step is to develop through, you know, meditation practices and mindfulness techniques to even recognize it. This is the very first step, isn't it? But the heart essential job is giving it up, not following it, not following it. So it's sort of like cold turkey. But of course, according to our own levels. Everything is according to our own level, you know. That's the basis. So the antidote to attachment. So you have to, if it is the cause of suffering, we have to first recognize it, and that can take years even to even see it. And then it's an ongoing job. It's something I can see. It's almost like I go, wow, that's attachment. That's interesting. I almost haven't seen it before, you know. It's because I think that just points to how deeply, how insidious, how deep it is, how subtle it is, how pervasive it is, you know. I mean, the whole structure, as you know, the whole structure of what Buddhism is, the methods, there's the presentation itself of what this, that, cause of suffering, blah, blah. So then the fourth noble truth is the methods, the whole path. And that's, I mean, I haven't presented that here, that, you know, but in a sense, to really understand, there's no shortcut and there's no secret to it. So the first step is to recognize. And we can see this, I'm not just talking about only having one piece of chocolate cake. That's a good start, you know. And it certainly feels like suffering to only have one piece of chocolate when you're really dying for two, you know. But most of the time we even do that because we don't want to be fat. It's not because we want to try and change our mind. And that's something interesting too. We can be very disciplined. Let's say in the gross level of attachment now, we can be disciplined in our lives, you know. But it's usually we just replace it with another object because we don't really see that the cause of the suffering isn't the cake. The cause of the suffering is the neurotic mind grasping at it. So that's the key thing, you know.
So one. The cancellation of the attachment.
Uh-huh. That's one. Yeah.
I have a garden at home, and I don't get the root of the weed out.
That's it. That's right. Exactly. Well, that's the one of ego grasping. That's the root. The one of the even of the positing of the me in the first place.
Right.
That's the root. That's the root.
Seems like
you can
get to that.
Well, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Absolutely. That's it. Of course it is. So, but the point is, it's obvious, isn't it? If you've got like oak tree size weeds, to start talking about pulling out the root is a bit premature, isn't it? So right now, Buddha's saying, yeah, that's right. And the tree, you know, the branches, if you like, are the attachment, the anger, the jealousy, the pride, the neurosis, the lying, the stealing, the killing, all those other things that we can see. They're the flourishing top of it. Then when you started to, and that's why, certainly in Buddha's practice, the whole first level of practice, which is encompassed in the first level of vows, you know, the practice is there to control the growing, at least to control the growing of the anger, jealousy, pride and the rest. So then you at least subdue them a little bit, then you can start working on the weeds, because that working on the root, of course. That's the, yeah, then, I mean, that's the bottom, that's the one. So even put it in very traditional Buddhist terms too, you know, you develop some kind of control in your meditation. And in your daily life, some kind of discipline where you're subduing the crazy mouth, where you don't, you know, shoot your mouth off every 2 minutes, and you're controlling that one. You're controlling your actions so you don't abuse and harm too many beings. Then you have the space in your own meditation to really observe the mind. Then you start to control the mind itself and the kind of raging train just doing its own trip day and night. And slowly, slowly you get some kind of, and this is years and years of practice, to the point where you actually really do have such a level of well-being that even just compared with now, it's just beyond belief. And you haven't even finished the delusions yet. Do you see what I'm saying? You get to a point where the mind is so subdued and so naturally blissful and kind and joyous, and then you really, in your meditation, having developed single point of concentration, can get to start to do the job of actually realizing emptiness, which is what is the one that uproots the root. You know, does that make sense? Yeah. Of course you can. No, that's the point. Of course it is. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Cliff. Say it again, sorry. What are you saying?
Antidote?
Yes. Yes, yes.
Question.
Yes.
So, to renounce or to give up. So, my question.
Give up what, Cliff?
Yes.
Give up what?
To give up what you attach.
No, that's not true at all.
Or renounce your self-grasping.
Well, that's too. No, you said that that's quite different. Self-grasping is ignorance. And we're talking here about. If you're talking about attachment, you must talk about attachment, not self-ignorance, not self-grasping. They're two different things, Cliff. So which one are you talking about?
Attachment.
And what is attachment? Cliff?
Attachment is your mental attitude.
It's what?
Uh-huh,
okay.
That,
so then?
That doesn't see the things as where they are.
No, that's ignorance.
The attachment, the mental attitude that sort of exaggerates
okay.
the quality.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, right. So then, what do you say? Yeah, right. So what do you say?
And so if you actually recognize that you are suffering from this attachment,
yes.
then to liberate yourself
yes.
is to, you know, give up the attachment.
That's right. I mean, I know it's like many-sided thing, isn't it? There are many, you know, there are many things there. It's like you just, any old habit, you know. Right now, if you're a smoker, I use these simple examples because they're very just simple examples and they're very obvious. If you're completely addicted to smoking, so you can say, you know, the smoking part of you is really strong. The wanting cigarettes is very highly developed muscles inside. And the not wanting to smoke is a little baby muscle this big. So that's the weakness you're talking about, right? So how do you start developing a big muscle? How do you start developing a muscle, Cliff? You have to exercise it, dear. So every now and again, you have to have the courage to say, oh, all right, I don't want to give up smoking, you know. You dare to say it to yourself. And then slowly you start to build that thought up to the point where, you know, that thought begins slowly to have power, you know. But what makes you even want to develop that muscle is the recognition in your face that you're fed up with the suffering of smoking. So you have to even first recognize that. Because you won't have the power to even want to give up cigarettes unless you see the suffering. And that's using that as the analogy here. Until we even begin to contemplate what is attachment. Even to look at the nature of it. Even to get a feeling. Because right now we think what we mean by attachment, we think it's called happiness. We call it the wrong thing. So this needs itself a lot of courage, even before you begin changing it. So it's an evolutionary process that needs many different approaches, you understand? But yes, you're absolutely right. It's that the muscle inside, it's just using that as a story, you know, is very weak right now because it hasn't been exercised. So the aim is just to keep looking at the suffering until, I mean, that's why, Cliff, I tell you, why some of these friends of mine in prison really practice much harder than we do. Because, darling, they don't need to be convinced that they are, that suffering is disgusting and they are fed to their teeth. And you know yourself, Cliff, if anything goes wrong in your life, when you really start to practice, even for a day. Because you see it so starkly. The angry mind, the jealous mind, the mind that's just freaking out. But when everything's going nicely, it's really hard to see. And this is interesting, and this is exactly why, and I always quote the Lama Zopa when he wrote to one of these guys, you know, your prison is nothing in comparison with the prison of Rabina and Cliff. Because when Rabina and Cliff think, it's like we're getting the junk all the time. And as long as you're getting the junk all the time, you don't think you're suffering. Do you see my point? But they can't get the junk in there. So therefore you are forced in the face of your own suffering. So we often need the wake-up calls, you know. Then we start to get strong. So to really be in an ordinary life where you're not grossly suffering and to see this stuff needs a lot of clear, intelligent mind to really see it, to really analyze. Isn't it? Not an easy job, you know. So this is why sometimes suffering can be the best wake-up call for us. Extreme suffering, losing somebody leaving you, can be the best catalyst for some changes to happen. Every one of us knows that, you know. Losing all your money, you know, getting cancer. Unbelievable wake-up calls. That's exactly what one of my friends in prison, when he woke up in a car accident, having been a junk all his life and killed somebody, you know, was the wake-up call, he said. A complete wake-up call. This huge catharsis he went through, you know, transformed his life finally. But it took that and having life in prison to finally do it to him, you know. That's how thick we are. That's how stupid we are, you know. So, the first step is to really see. Not just kind of have this guilty sort of, oh, I better give up attachment, you know. You've got to know it. When you really can know it yourself, you don't, you know, eventually you've got, that gives you great, that gives you power. That gives you power. So we have to just look, analyze, just all just catch it, watch, look, you know. And the fact is, as Dalai Lama says, if you can really from your own direct experience decide that what Buddha says is not true, then of course stop it immediately. Buddha's wrong. Reject him, you know. So it's not a question of guilt and just blind belief. That's just sort of childish. Using our own minds, using our own intelligence is the most important thing. So I mean, he's either wrong or he's not, isn't it? It's either right or wrong. He's not challenging us really, not forcing it down our throats. He's either right or he's not. That's up to us. No one's forcing us to be Buddhist or even to practice 1% of it, you know. Anything else, people? Chris? You already will feel so powerful. Yes, you're empowered. This process, what it brings is an enormous sense of empowerment in the right way. Absolutely, Cliff. You have great courage and strength. And you know that you don't want the suffering anymore. So you have a great, it's like self-respect. The person who's able, using in the ordinary gross analogy, just give up being a junkie and give up being an alcoholic, it shows great self-respect. But the fact that you can do it, it indicates we have great power. So, that's exactly right. And it doesn't bring weakness, or I'm lost, or I'm giving up everything, I've got nothing left, life's pathetic. That's terrible. But the second we start exercising or tasting our own potential, rather than tasting the cake, which is based on the belief that you're empty now and cake will give it to you. But when you start exercising your own potential to have power over the cake, immediately satisfaction comes. That's what's interesting. The second you do that, that one time you exercise your own power, instead of being empowered, you know, overwhelmed by the cake, which is essentially what attachment is. Attachment is like a baby that says, I'm nothing, and all these gorgeous things out there, you know. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's the real weakness. That's the child's mind, which is how we all are. That's samsara. The moment we exercise our own power, that itself instantly, and that's in that most direct answer to Sue's question, that instant you don't follow attachment, although it feels like the pain of giving up, it actually brings power because you're tasting your own power to do something, you're tasting your own potential. So you just develop that a million times. Then you really are, you become who you really are then. A fully satisfied person, fully developed, blissful being. Do you see? God, no. Everything's a question of what you do with it, isn't it? Absolutely. No problem then. You can have everything then. That's the point. Once we've gone out of being locked, overwhelmed by the object, then we have the power. Simple way of saying, when we have the power, you can have cakes, you can have whatever you like, 32 wives, honey, it's cool. You understand my point? I mean, it's like, that's whether we want them then is another point. But when we have found the power here, the cake has stopped having power. Therefore, one way of saying it is that's when the suffering's gone. It's another indication of the suffering having gone, you know.
So does that work with possessions?
Say it again.
I understand, connection with, my wife.
Yes.
Because I love her.
That's right.
I'm attached to her, but I guess I really love her.
Yes.
I'm
That's it.
That applies to possessions.
Exactly. I mean, it's very interesting. You have in the history of, say, Mahayana Buddhism, you have all these stories of these kind of, like ridiculously rich, powerful kings and queens and people who govern worlds, you know. But because they're truly to the point of being just total altruism, that they've manifested in that world as that person so they can benefit people. So it's effortless. They just use it to benefit others. And we can see that. We can see some people who have a lot of things but have big hearts and are not attached, so they can give it all away and they keep getting more. It's interesting. So for sure, yeah. When you've really given up attachment and you have altruism in your heart, then you have everything you have for the sake of others then. And that itself is just immense joy to oneself, you know, because it's sort of like you finish the job. You're now full. You're done. You're full. So now you can benefit others, you know. And that's why you use everything you need, everything you've got. It makes complete sense, you know. So that's why. So put it like this. If you know you're grossly attached to a certain object, it is appropriate sometimes to give up the object, to give yourself some space to look on the mind, you know. But for most of us, we mightn't be that attached. But we have to look at that. I mean, the sign that you're attached to something is when you lose it, you freak out. So test yourself every now and again. You know what I mean? Doesn't mean, of course we're attached. I mean, the thought of losing your wife is heartbreaking. But that's the thing too, what's interesting. Coming in this whole package is sort of some love, some attachment, some this, some that, all this big mixture all together. Like in this glass of liquid, a bit of milk, a bit of water, a bit of something else. So right, all we have to do, what we're trying to do is grow the love part. And the sign that there's love in a relationship is it lasts when all the fire finishes. I mean, look at the relationships that don't last and they're just anger and jealousy take over. It's because it's mostly attachment. Do you see my point? But if there is real love there, that's what makes a relationship last, you know. And it grows more and more and more. Okay, the attachment can grow too, but one has to just observe that, you know. It's really just like a lot of awareness of the different qualities within us and observing them. And the sign, a really interesting sign of it being attachment, is even the second a person says what you don't want, you get irritable and get annoyed and don't like it, you know. That's a sign there was attachment to there. But if the person, if the person you love doesn't do what you want, and that's a sign of attachment. But if the person you love doesn't do what you want and you kind of are able to work through it and let go and accept and be happy for them, then that's a sign that love is most prevalent. And that the aim is to grow that one. That's the point. And so in other words, if you're feeling good inside, it's the sign there's some virtue there. If you're feeling kind of that one, it's a sign of the delusion there. It's a very simple kind of little litmus test, you know. Makes sense, doesn't it? What else then? I missed that bit. What do you mean? Sometimes what you do doesn't matter. What do you mean?
It's like your action, I'm not attached to the results of my action. So it really doesn't matter what I do. And so I feel free to do whatever I want as long as I'm not attached.
According to whom? Who says this?
I've heard, you know, some teachers, their goal is enlightenment. So they want to be free from attachment to any of the worldly things that you're.
Who says all that? I've never heard any of this before. This is not Buddhist teachings that I understand.
You know, I've encountered and I've met some teacher from the various traditions that the goal is freedom from attachment to things.
Yeah.
And so if you attain that state, you're living in the moment. And so sometimes your actions is coming from some spontaneous.
Well, it sounds to me the way I'm only going on your words now, and I know what you're talking about, I know, but I want to just go on your words. It sounds to me not a very good state, what you're describing. And whether you're accurately describing what you think other people are saying is another point, you know. The point is, according to Buddhism, the way I'm understanding it from the teachings I've received, the more you look at the delusions in the mind, the more you understand how they cause you pain and how they necessarily cause you to harm others, then if you give them up, if I give up attachment, which means this neurotic I want and I need, as if I'm some inferior, separate, neurotic being, and I develop the fullness of my being, then necessarily I will only have kindness towards you. It will be impossible to ever have an angry thought about you, to even if you harm me, to even be angry with you, to want to harm you. It's an impossibility, because anger and the rest come from attachment. It's just impossible to have. So then I'd only have a sense of moral responsibility. It would be impossible not to. So the thing is, I know sort of often the way Zen, I'm not criticizing Zen now, but the way often Zen can be interpreted is that it doesn't matter what you do, and you don't, you know, you're beyond rules, you can do anything, you can have 49 things, you can kill 27 people. I mean, that is in a sense a conclusion that is accurate, but it's not the point, because you'd only do that if it were beneficial. Even if you haven't achieved bodhicitta yet, you're the highest level of great compassion, altruism, where you only want to only benefit others. You would naturally only do what is coming from a pure place. Now, the point is, when you're really a highly developed being in this side, and you've got the compassion side as well, very developed, because you've also got power of mind to see people and to see future and past, you might see that if you kill that person now, you'll prevent 42,000 other people from dying. And at the moment in time, because nobody else is clairvoyant, they can't see. In other words, let's say you could see that those two guys in Middleton were going to kill those people. Let's just say that. You're a great being, and you had clairvoyance, and you had enormous compassion. Do you understand my point? And you decided you're going to kill these two boys. Now, do you think anybody's going to believe you? You'd be the one on the death, you'd be on death row. Do you see my point here? But that's a possibility. Buddhist terms, once you've really developed, one of the other consequences of developing your mind and getting rid of attachment is you develop enormous powers like clairvoyance into past and future, because it's the presence of all the thick delusions now that prevent us from seeing past and future. In Buddhist terms, this is just part of the deal. You see my point? And if you've developed, not only have you developed nirvana in yourself, but you've also developed enormous compassion for others, that their suffering is unbearable, then you will do what look like outrageous actions, but you know where you're coming from. And you won't say, hey, I'm clairvoyant, I'm a bodhisattva. They'll just think you're even madder and put you in a madhouse as well. Do you see my point? So yes, indeed, when you're really at that level, you can even do what looks like negative, but there's no way it's even a fraction of negative. It's only coming from the purest place. Does that make sense? Does that answer your questions, do you think? Well, not really.
Your actions do make a difference. Once you are at a high level, there is no need to harm anybody.
No, for your own side, for your sake, absolutely no need to harm a single being. It just wouldn't even arise, you know. This wouldn't even arise, because any time we harm people now, it's usually out of attachment and grasping and anger and me being threatened. So when there's no longer an I to be threatened, when you are like blissful and your consciousness is like pervading the universe and your oneness with all beings, I mean, harming's irrelevant. This wouldn't arise, you see. And that's what it means by going beyond rules and all that. Right, I mean, it's like, once you're at that level, of course you don't need to have rules of morality, because you are naturally moral. It's in that sense you've gone beyond them. Do you see? Not in the sense of you don't care about them, and therefore you abuse them. That's just another way of having delusion, you know. Do you see the difference? Well, it feels like the end. Isn't the end? No? Questions? No? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely.
And so I don't know if the problem is that when people try to change, people notice the difference right away.
Yes.
And they will try to tell you, well, what's wrong with you? You know, how can you behave differently? You know, like, how shall I say? You know, they try to drag you back to the way you are, or the, you know, we try to change, to take a different path. And they would say, well, that doesn't, you know, that's nonsense, you know, let's go and do something, you know, all this stuff. And yet, we, you know, like, when we talk here, and then we say, oh, this is great, but then when we go out there, and then we say, everybody is doing different.
I understand, yes.
We tend to
go back to. Yes, that's right. Yeah, absolutely, yes. Exactly.
So it's kind of difficult.
It is difficult, yes.
We talk here and then we say, okay, this is the way.
That's
I'm
right.
I'm fed up with suffering, yes. I'm yes. fed up with this attachment.
Mm.
And then we go out there.
That's right.
By all these, especially in this country.
Exactly.
You know, this, we believe in how we see,
yes.
how we hear, very
yes.
direct you know,
yes.
reaction
yes.
to the material world.
That's right.
So, it's,
so then?
It's very difficult. Mm. How can we know?
Well, it's like if you were trying to give up being an alcoholic, you wouldn't keep going back to the bar, would you?
No.
So it's difficult when everything is a bar, I agree. So to have one, at least one friend who can support you. Yeah, I know, but I'm talking using that as an analogy. I'm using the bar as an analogy for samsara, like what you're talking about. So you, as you don't have a choice, as this is the world, you just have to learn. I mean, it sounds a bit arrogant, maybe. It's just not meant to be. You have to learn to select your friends and learn to be around people. That's why if you really are seriously trying to practice some kind of path, if you're learning to practice tennis, you don't keep going and hanging out with football players. Do you see my point? You have to find other tennis players, dear. That's your responsibility. Otherwise, you'll keep forgetting that you're a tennis player. You keep playing football. Do you see my point?
Okay.
It's very simple.
So, I guess it's kind of like, you start alienating.
No, you don't have to alienate people. No, you don't.
You start finding all, things that you don't, I have this friend, for instance. And then he starts saying well, you're different, you don't like this, like that. So we start having less time, sharing time together.
That's okay. Well, that's all right.
And then, but then at the same time, I fear losing the friend.
Okay, well, you have to look at that, don't you?
Yeah.
What is it you fear losing?
Yeah.
What is it about? I mean, you just have to look carefully. So there are several points there. One point is, you can actually be a Buddhist, even a 1% Buddhist, and you don't have to look different to anybody. It's very internal. That's one thing, to develop that skill. And then secondly, of course you have to reassess. It's like anything in your life, like the same analogy as the tennis player, if you're starting now to develop new interests, let's say. So naturally, certain friends will start to fall away, but you don't do it with a negative attitude, you don't do it being arrogant. Yes, it's a bit painful sometimes, but you have to just look at it and not just make too many decisions, but just allow it. And if every day you're making a decision you want to try and be the good person and practice there and do this and do that, then slowly you'll develop a new thing. It's just this transition time is a bit painful. Do you see? But one has to be skillful. You have to check your own mind,
But it's still like your old friends, right?
Yeah, of course. There's no, and in the end, sure. I understand. Just go one day at a time, Try not to impose big rules on yourself and try not to find fault. It's important to do that. Don't separate yourself by thinking, oh, I'm being so pure now and all these ordinary people out there. It can be this very common way to people become. It's not appropriate. It just becomes arrogant. And it cuts you off unnecessarily. You should try and develop a good heart, Remember that. Do you understand? Right. Let's finish. So, just a little prayer, that's all. The way Buddhism's saying karma works, as you've heard. Each moment, we're sowing seeds in the mind. So we've been sowing, as many seeds as many moments as there have been since we started, around a quarter, whatever. All these seeds, may they ripen in our minds. May all the things we've thought about, listened to, contemplated, may we use our own, we develop our own courage to see our own minds, to really recognize what is suffering, what is happiness, what is the causes of it. Learn to eliminate the causes and to grow the causes of happiness. And yes, it's always painful. Changing anything is always painful. Which is why to have the clarity to really understand why you're doing it gives you the courage to want to do it. Rather than doing it out of vague idea or doing it out of guilt, So may all that ripen. And may eventually, as a result of these seeds we're planting, all of this ripen in the development of our own phenomenal potential. For our sake and the sake of others. Kewa jinyu du dag lama sangge drup gyur ne dro wa chi kyang ma lu pa ke ki sa la ka pa shok jang
troops and chogrin poche, ma ke panam ke guchig, ke panyam pa me payang, gong ne gondu pa washo.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.